The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited. Even
no team.
Environmental stuff, ideally with some sort of international aspect.
And, you know, tell us your name.
My name is Christina.
And also, zodiac sign is always
here. Aries.
Yeah, there it is.
Aubrey Scorpio.
I'm not 100% sure. I'm getting my master's in international studies right now, something definitely international. But I'm kind of open to a lot of stuff, and I'm curious about clinic and how that works, I guess.
I'm not really sure, and my name is Maya.
I'm Laura. I'm an academic counselor. I'm a Pisces. We've talked over the phone and email.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
Good to meet you.
Yeah. I'm Scott. I'm interested in sustainable development. And I'm just kind of open to anything.
Excellent. I'd like to hear that.
I'm Bob, and I'm a Taurus.
Aries. So, Amanda Ross.
Yeah. What are your areas? We had to say our areas.
That's true.
Yes. Good question. Well, I'll give you a quick background. And basically, my story in terms of relevance to this discussion is, in law school, I went to law school thinking I wanted to be a public defender. And I had worked at the Public Defender Service as an investigator, took a lot of criminal law classes, took a clinic on juvenile defense, did some work in death penalty work, thought that's what I was going to do. And then kind of towards the end of my time in law school, actually during clinic, which was useful, I realized that was not the best fit for me. I still wanted to represent underrepresented interests, but I realized that the criminal law, criminal defense area was just not ideal. I wasn't ideally suited for it. It didn't play to my strengths, and I found it emotionally draining, et cetera. So did a clerkship and then applied to work for Public Citizen, which is a consumer rights organization. That's a very broad way of describing it. I mean, it really, especially the litigation group, took on any issue that they thought that was underrepresented. So it sort of perfectly fit my needs in that way. There was a lot of policing of the legal system, policing of government regulatory agencies, a lot of suing the government, which is a lot of fun. I highly recommend. Did a lot of open government work, a whole range of issues, usually appellate work. It's a very good fit for me. And in thinking about course selection, I think my story suggests, and I think I'm not alone in this, that one should be open-minded about the courses you take, even if you think you know your area, and some of you do, some of you don't. I think it's always good to keep in mind that your interests might change, and I think a slightly broader range of courses is never a bad idea.
Yeah. I am the director of the clinical program here, which is my second stint. I already went through the whole parole process, was out in the community, but was brought back in because I reoffended. And I've done other things in the school. But in addition to directing the clinical program, I also specifically direct the disability rights clinic. So my substantive area of interest is ADA, disability rights, and Laura and I and David Jaffe deal with some of those things within the school. I don't deal with it programmatically, but more at the academic end, and of course now in the clinic. Prior to coming to WCL, it just seems like yesterday, but actually it was 1983, I worked for 5 years at the Civil Rights Division of Justice in a special litigation section, which does, or did and still does, investigations and lawsuits against state institutions, I mean, mental hospitals, mental retardation institutions, juvenile delinquency, and prisons and jails, which was a wonderful job for 5 years. Really felt like you were a public interest lawyer in the government, at least the way it was back then and for what we were doing. Changed a little bit when Ronald Reagan came in, and that's when I took the hint and decided to leave and come here, where I've been since. And I agree with Amanda. I mean, we'll talk about this. One of the things about looking at public interest is to think, not only to keep options open, but to think broadly what kinds of courses might actually benefit you, some of the ones you might not think of as related to being a public interest lawyer. I've learned over the years could be really helpful. And I do a lot of work with local organizations here in town, serving on boards and consulting with them on different things. And for example, lots of organizations really need people who understand corporate governance, and, you know, understand what it means to be a nonprofit organization, what do's and don'ts about how you organize things. And a lot of, you know, public interest lawyers of Amanda's generation or my generation, you know, they never took any of those things. Oh, you know, who needs business stuff? That's the other side. In fact, it's actually quite helpful to know those things. So, and increasingly, you know, people like in my area, people with disabilities are now forming their own organizations. So they need legal advice at very public interest oriented. How do we set ourselves up? Here's what we want to achieve. What are the forms in which we do it? So I always say that there are certain kinds of courses that you might think of as really very far from your interests, which could be very helpful.
There's a great tradition of students from the school starting their own organizations. I mean, it's sort of amazing, actually. And so you might want the corporate governance corporate class to help you with your lawsuit involving corporate governance issues. Or you might need it because you yourself are setting up some sort of organization and you need to know the rules.
Yeah.
And so I think there are good reasons to take those courses that might not at first seem like they're the perfect fit. And I think my sense of what I advocate, of course, everybody's, you know, situation is a little different. Any advice you should always take with that grain of salt, depending on how it applies to you. But if you have a sense of what you want to do, by all means, take courses in that area. You take courses with some sense of you want to be able to write the cover letter to the employer saying how you have background relevant to their job, proving your interest in it and proving your ability. But just don't get so focused on your area that you bleed out some core courses that might be useful to have. And exploring other issues, other areas of law that you might.
I'll give you a good example. A student is in my disability law seminar. I teach that. Second year student, and she's going to do the disability rights clinic next year. And she's also a dean's fellow, so you know she knows me pretty well. And she just came in the other day and said, "Well, I'm going to take clinic, and I have this other course, and then I have to choose between, I think it was civil rights and remedies or feminist jurisprudence. And what do you think?" And I said, well, one thing to consider, you're doing all this disability stuff. She's very interested in that. And if you do civil rights and remedies, it's going to be also, not completely, but a lot related to that. But it might be then a good reason to take feminist jurisprudence because it's different enough to give you a different perspective on issues. And it's good to have that kind of thing. And not, you know, partly for making sure you're testing widely in terms of possible careers, but also to look at law school as sometimes taking courses you're never going to do afterwards. You know, you could take a CLE course in wills, trusts, and estates if you don't take it here and you want to go later and your parents say, okay, we paid all this money for you, go to law school, we'd like you at least to get a will out of you. You're not going to go for CLE for feminist jurisprudence. So, you know, when you're thinking, this is a little beyond just the issue of clinic or public interest, but, you know, try to think of a range of courses, some of which are just, you know, you're in an academic institution. What a wonderful opportunity sometimes to not just be kind of career focused, but you know, here's something I'm really interested in. You might, you know, begin a lifelong or continue a lifelong interest in reading and other things that you'll never be able to make a direct, you know, A to B connection from a career standpoint, but it just makes you, you know, more interested in things that go on in the world.
And getting that little bit of base of information from a course can really help. I know for myself when I start thinking about an area of law that I didn't happen to take a course in, I find it, even today, when I should have all these research skills and abilities, it's a little bit, I feel more at sea. Than I never took international law, and I should have, and it's just always felt like, so okay, I lack some of the fundamentals there. You know, maybe that's me being, not realizing that in fact international law is something I could pick up on my own, but the point I'm trying to make here is that it's helpful to have a base in a couple different areas that you think you might want to explore more on your own. You can do it on your own, but it's nice to have that course to lay the foundation.
Now, you know, I think all this is right. Let me suggest a couple of kinds of courses that I think actually work pretty broadly in different areas. And, you know, several of you have talked about environmental law, for example.
Yeah.
Administrative law, critical course. I mean, if you're going to be a public interest lawyer in Washington, you've got to know administrative law. We've got some, I mean, all across the board, we have some wonderful faculty. We have some particularly good ones, I think, in that area. It's something which, you know, I think maybe in a school not in Washington has a sort of lower profile, but I think here it's critical. Environmental law is highly administrative, as you know. And so understanding that, great thing. You know, you can link that if you're working on a journal or something like that, but that's a good kind of course to take. I think evidence, whether you think you're going to be a litigator or not, it's a really important course just to understand what counts as proof within hearings and courts. Again, as in the clinic, it's actually an essential course, but even more generally, it's one of those, you know, not required once you're past, we don't have much required past first year in prim pro and legal ethics, but I think it's one of those that you don't take at your, you know, if you don't take it, you're really missing on something. I'd say that about tax, too, which might, again, strike you as odd, but I think it's a very, much more policy-oriented than you think, heavily statutory, which is another, I think, important thing. First year in particular, you get a sense that it's all common law, not all, but you know, heavily. Most of what lawyers do is, especially in this town, is really heavily statutory and regulatory, so it's something to do. And I can say this because it's not my course, it's Amanda's, but a course like federal courts, which is a tough course. But it's really important to know if you think you're going to be in a situation where you're going to be filing cases and understanding that, you know, it's really like an advanced procedure in a lot of ways.
And yeah, federal courts, especially if you're going to sue governments, which a lot of public interest lawyers do. I think federal courts is a good course for that. And Steve Lodick teaches it as well as I do.
Yeah. So those are some kinds of courses. I think also you obviously have, you know, one of the things you have to do before you graduate is do your level writing. Being able to write well as a critical lawyering skill in whatever area you do, it's especially important, I think, in public interest. So finding a seminar in an area you're interested in. I for example, my bias is, I think it's, if you have a choice, students don't always go in this direction. I think it's better to write a paper in the context of a seminar where it's not just an independent study or just your law review comment or note, because you benefit from the seminar discussion, even if it's not exactly on your topic. And I know when I teach my disability seminar, the students have to go through outline and draft and comments and redrafting, and I get to work with them pretty closely. And I think that process, again, does a number of things. One is it, you know, for many students, you haven't necessarily had to do a lot of that before law school, so that's a different experience. It can give you a good writing sample. It can give you something you can get published, which can be helpful, again, in a lot of different areas. So, you know, those are some of those kinds of things. But I guess the other thing I'd say, which is probably subversive, is I'm a big take the professor type person, which is, you know, what I say to folks, well, I'm not going to say, well, here's the good professors, here's the not so good. But what I would, one thing I would think about is, who have you really liked, say, during the first year? And I don't mean like necessarily personally, but whose style really fits for you? And so I really get what she's doing in the classroom. And then try to seek out and say, well, I like, you know, I like Professor Frost as the Civ Pro, so like who else tend to teach us like her 101? So your stuff.
Yeah.
but that's a way to kind of, because there are different styles. And the fact is that you have different range of learning styles, some of which fit well with some faculty, some less well. And you know, if you wind up taking a course in an area you're not interested in because you think you need to have it, it's a bar course or something like that. So in an area you're not interested in, from a professor you're not particularly interested in taking it from, you know, life's too short. You know, I think you learn, I mean, sometimes it's a lot better to take, you know, in my law school, I didn't do this, so I learned this lesson. A lot of people took admiralty. You know, they had no interest in being admiralty lawyers, but it was taught by Charles Black, who was this wonderful, you know, law professor, activist. And it was basically, they could have called the course anything. They could have called it bananas. And actually, at Yale, they did call many of the courses that. But the point was, you know, great teacher making an area that you would have not thought of is necessarily what you were interested in, making it interesting. So better, of course, if you can link it to something you are interested in.
Just a couple things to add, and then I think we should turn to questions. One is, if you're interested in litigating, there's a couple of great options here. One is the Trial Advocacy Workshop, which is it's co-taught by a practitioner and a judge. There's a bunch of different sections of it, and each one has a practitioner and a judge. And it's, you get to do or open, you do a trial. You are assigned the trial materials, and you interview and prepare witnesses, and then you hold a trial in front of an actual judge, because one of the teachers of the class is a judge. You do opening argument, closing argument, you cross-examine witnesses. At the end of the course, you do another trial in front of a jury made up of high school students, which is probably, you know, a pretty good example of the kind of people you have to convince when you're actually litigating cases. I think it's a great opportunity to learn those skills. And you can also learn if you like it, because I think it can be, some people just love that, and then some people find that it's not their cup of tea. That's one course that I think is a good way to test litigation skills. I also have to say, doing clinic, if you want to do direct service coming out of law school, one, it's a good way of developing those skills that you're not getting in your regular classroom courses, learning how to talk with clients and prepare cases and deal with local courts and administrative agencies. And two, it's a great thing to have on your resume when you're trying to convince a public interest organization to hire you. And then the third and last comment is, we're so lucky here in D.C., we have great adjuncts who work in great organizations in the city. So while I don't recommend not taking our faculty, because I like our faculty, I also think keep an eye on who's coming in to teach a course as an adjunct. It might be a course that's both in an area that fascinates you, taught by someone with a high-level position in an organization you want to work for. You know, that is not unusual. So That's another, I think, good strategy, just sort of thinking ahead to the job.
And I agree we should open it, but just to mention, of course, we have a very big externship program.
Yes, good.
And, of course, our externship program, you cannot work in the profit arena, so it has to be for government or public interest. So it's a terrific way to both learn what the organization is doing and, of course, to make contacts. And many, many people who wind up going into a public interest job from here did so after having interned. Because once you're there and they see what you're doing and like you, there's really no way to top that in terms of experience. And it also, as Amanda said, it gives you a sense of whether you'd like that work. I mean, sometimes what happens is the area is really interesting, and then you get to the workplace, and for whatever reason, it's just not, doesn't play to your strengths, and you can't really know that from the outside, but from the inside. So, what else that we haven't covered? I can talk more about clinic after.
Well, I've heard that it's very difficult. I remember the comments, everybody said it was very difficult to get in public interest. Is that really the case across the board, and is it realistic to do something more traditional like clerkship, law firm, and then try to do public interest part-time? How do you get into public interest?
That's a great question.
You know, it really varies. It's certainly a different, and of course right now, because of the economy, almost all bets are off in terms of what you can get or not. And, you know, you used to be able to say, well, law firms are interviewing early, make their decisions earlier. If you're going to go into public interest, you have to be prepared to know later, because most public interest organizations don't know in September and October when their budget's going to be the year after. Well, now no one knows, so at some level it's kind of leveled down to that. But it also means that there are public interest organizations that are facing significant funding challenges. You know, foundation funding is down, so if you're dependent on that, that's going to hurt you. So there are places that are hurting. And there are also, an interesting phenomenon is that there are law firms that are urging their incoming lawyers to delay their start at the law firm, and in some cases paying them, you know, half the law firm salary, which is a pretty nice salary, and saying, you know, get lost for a year, work for public interest, which is actually a very nice thing for those who want to do that and maybe felt, well, they needed to go to, or wanted to go to a firm or needed to pay off their loans or something, and it's something to do like that. I guess what I would say is this. When I was in law school, the summer after my second year, I worked in New York at a law firm, and there was one of these sessions for associates working in New York to come to hear John Shattuck, who now is, I think, head of the Kennedy Library, and has had various important positions. At that time, it was with the ACLU. He said, okay, forget about public interest. It's hard to get jobs. There's no jobs. You know, basically, better to go into the private sector and do pro bono. I found that a very dispiriting message as somebody who really went to law school thinking I would want to do something in the public interest. So to me, the idea is to be realistic about it, but also, you know, to follow your dream if that's what that is. What I would say is it may require greater flexibility. That you have to sort of assess your own situation. Everybody wants to work, you know, public interest in Washington or New York or San Francisco. There's some wonderful jobs that are a little bit off the beaten path. Now, is that, you know, are you in a personal situation where that's a possibility or not? What do we mean by public interest? Well, you know, legal services or direct service things, there's lots and lots of need, often in places that are not seen as quite so desirable. But, you know, you can do wonderful things, and again, depends on your circumstances. There are firms that are smaller that have significant amount of public interest or pro bono work they do, and you have to maybe explore a little bit to see who is doing what and whether that work is valued. Because sometimes you'll speak to a firm that'll say, well, fine for us for you to do pro bono public interest work, as long as you give us your 2,200 billable hours, and then from 4 to 6 in the morning is when you can do that work. So you want to understand whether it's tolerated at one level, you know, first of all, not allowed, or tolerated, or actually encouraged, and then things made so that you can do that. So some of it is, you know, you indicated earlier, sustainable development. So I think, you know, you want to look more narrowly. Well, who are the folks who are doing this? I think one of our first, one of the people in the first class of public interest scholars, Melissa Frisk, I know she was just, her picture was in the Washington Lawyer magazine, she was speaking about it. I remember she was very environmentally oriented. And so what I think, and Amanda's exactly right, there's also students who have taken the bull by the horns and said, well, I really want to do, you know, this area of domestic violence, and I'm not seeing a job out there. How about creating an organization? I mean, how cool is that? So there's a lot of, you know, if you're creative, and again, depends on your own skill set and how entrepreneurial you are and what, you know, backstops you have, if you have them, there's some possibilities out there. But you have to be, I'd say, prepared, be a little flexible, maybe it's not the first job, maybe it's the third job you get. And I think, you know, when you're looking to what jobs to get right out of school, a lot of it is thinking, I think, about, I know my perspective was I wound up not having so many jobs, although I had a lot in here. But I remember thinking what I wanted to do was make sure each job was getting me, you know, moving a lot. I was learning something from it. Either it was the area I was interested in or the skills. And that way I could think, okay, there's a reason, you know, this is making sense. So if it's a good, if it's a job where you can learn good litigation skills, even if it's not in the area of litigation you think you're interested in, well, maybe doing that for a little while is something. Then, when you're looking for public interest jobs, you can present yourself as somebody with some experience in that area. Because the thing about public interest is that they're much more streamlined organizations. They don't have a lot of time to kind of train you. You know, they want you to come, and you can speak to this better having more direct experience. But my sense is, you know, if you can come in as entry level or say, well, you know, I did this work in clinic, I know how to, I've had a jury trial, or I've had a significant administrative hearing, that's wonderful. That means there's just that much less they have to think about training you to do. Whereas at least in the old days with law firms, they would say, well, just give us your smart people and, you know, they'll sit around and learn from us for a while. It's a changing environment.
Just wanted to add that the clerkship, you mentioned clerkship. I mean, I think that's a great idea whether or not you're going into public interest law. It shouldn't be viewed as sometimes people view it as something you do if you're not a public interest lawyer. I mean, I don't think there's a requirement you do a clerkship if you don't want to, but I think they're a great way of getting that experience that you have a little bit. You know, I know from my clerkship that I was that much better a litigator because I'd had this experience of reading briefs and watching people argue cases and hearing how my judge was thinking about the case. How can that not be helpful?
Right.
I wish I'd done a district court one, quite frankly, in addition to a circuit court one. And then, the one other thing, I think sort of the point you made about just being a little bit tenacious about practicing public interest law. I just think you have to kind of keep trying. I have a friend who graduated from law school, did a clerkship, went to a law firm because she really didn't know what she wanted to do, really didn't like that, left after a year, knew she wanted to do urban planning. Hard to get into that field. It's not a field with a lot of money, not a field with a lot of organizations even. She ended up doing contract work for a lawyer for a law firm that was doing housing under a law called Hope 6, I think, that provided low-income sort of loans to do low-income housing. She was doing, you know, firm work, contracts and things like that, but she was in an area now that she wanted to move into, and she parlayed that job into a position at an urban planning organization, Smart Growth. So she kind of took that step by step, and it was really her third job that was the public interest job.
Yeah.
The second was sort of quasi-public interest. That's a typical move people make. So
I actually just kind of wanted to say, you may be very different from me, but I worked at a big firm, and I just, like, I was a paralegal, and I don't know how, like, I found it hard to, like, find time to look for a job. So I just, you know, and, you know, people will say, like, you know, looking for a job is a full-time job. Like, I don't know how you're working, you know, 70 or 80 hours or whatever, and also looking for a job. So if you're looking for one job with a thought to move somewhere else, you might want to think about sort of how much time I have for
that. That's a good point, that you have to have the time to look.
Right. It's always good, and this is another thing, even if you don't think anything's going to happen, it's always good to have a reasonably ready-to-go resume, because, you know, you get a call, someone thinks of you. If you're going to spend weeks putting your resume together, it may disappear.
You had mentioned that there's a lot of students that have gone on to create their own organizations. Do you know of any list of those organizations, possibly?
I don't know if they do. I mean, a lot of it is just what people, you know, WEAVE, for example, which is domestic violence. It's actually a broad domestic violence organization. I know, you know, it was created by one of our students.
You know, the public interest advisor, Jared Shirk, in the Office of Career Development, Professional Development, I think he would at least have word of mouth about those organizations.
Yeah. I don't know that I don't know that it's systematically kept, but it might be. That would probably be the office to
And I think our alumni are great. I mean, they really, we've got a great public interest network, in part because people come here with that interest, and in part because the PITS program, And you know, we get these folks who go off into the community and do wonderful things, and I think they're really supportive of their folks from their school. And so if you call them up, I'm sure they'll talk to you. And they, you know, best case scenario, I know somebody's got a job.
And then my second question, it's a little off topic, but I keep hearing at all these things people talk about getting published, and I understand that you can through a journal. What are the other ways of getting published and the benefits of it too?
Well, in law school, I guess I'd say there's the kind of, you know, three or four more academic-oriented journals like the Law Review and the International Law Review, the Gender Journal, and then Adler. Then there are a number of these, maybe one step below that, but very interesting kind of publications like the Human Rights Brief and the Health Law, and there's Environmental and Sustainable Environment, Development, and the Modern American. I mean, some, you know, there's a range of those, but I know the Human Rights Brief, which is the first one, is quite well thought of. And so, for example, if your interest was in human rights, that's a good place to do that. Also, I've had some students who have written a seminar paper, and at the end of the seminar, I've said to them, you know, you're done for the course, you satisfy your requirement. If you want to work on this more for publication, I'm happy to work with you. I think a lot of faculty do that. And then, you know, you can send it out. It's a lot easier than that to sort of send out things. And, you know, you might get another journal, even if you don't get it published here. And that's,
you know, Billie Jo Hoffman, I think our dean of the head of the library.
Right.
She, I know, all the time, there's like a couple times a year they do this celebration for students who've gotten published. So she must know of different avenues, different ways in which to. Sometimes there's competitions for the best article in a certain area.
Right. So there's I know the dean of students' office will, if you just like even look outside their door, there's all these, you know, there's labor competitions, employment. I'm sure there's environmental others as well. The reason to do it, I think it's a couple of things. One is I think it is it's like doing in undergrad as an honors thesis of some kind. That is you're really focusing intensely on some topic that after working on it, you're going to know a whole lot about, maybe a lot more than, you know, almost anyone else. There's some, I think, inherent interest in that. There's also, again, if you're thinking kind of instrumentally, it's on your resume, someone says, oh, I see you wrote a note about this, tell me about that. And then, you know, you know it so well, you can talk knowledgeably, that tends to, you know, because a lot of, you know, first-year courses are meant to be more survey-oriented. It's hard to get very deep in them. And so doing something in-depth in that is good. And other thing is that, again, quality of writing is so critical. It's not so much the same kind of writing as you would do, say, in a law review, you know. But being able to write clearly, write persuasively is an important skill. When you talk to lawyers in practice, they say, what's important in terms, what are we looking for? Always is right at the top of the list. I'm a real stickler for writing. I mean, a lot of times I'm in a situation where we're looking at people applying for jobs in the clinic or something. I mean, if your cover letter isn't well written, you don't get past that. You know, you may be wonderful, but you're not going to get past me, and that may be my bias, but I think there's a lot of needs out there. So just, you know, more opportunity to write, to edit, to kind of go through stuff and get it right. I think there's a sort of inherent value in that. And it was another one of those keeping your option open kinds of things, too. You know, it may turn out that, I didn't think I necessarily wanted to go into academia when I was in law school. I don't know if you did, but, you know, if you do some writing, it can be something that can be helpful to you later. So, but, like anything else, if you do it right, it's going to take a lot of time. You have to balance that with other things you might want to do. And I think a challenge with this law school, to be honest, is there's a lot going on. And we're in a city where there's a lot going on. And you have to be choosing, you know, and you can't do everything, so you have to really take on those things you can take on and do well, rather than do lots of things that you're doing a little bit of, where you don't feel any one of them is really at the level that you're satisfied with.
I might be mistaken, but did you work at the Judiciary Committee?
Yes.
Okay. So that seems very cool insofar as, at least for the judicial nominations, like you get a chance to be like, okay, concrete thing that I actually contributed to. And so I guess I'm sort of wondering where to look for those kinds of opportunities where you can say, like, I did that, like, something you pointed to, not necessarily, like, you know, that Amanda Frost did it, like, not necessarily publicity sort of aspect, but just, like, the, like, feeling, like, it wasn't just this long-term, like, think tank, maybe something came of it, maybe it didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think most jobs you get that feeling from, not just, in fact, if anything, I think judiciary can end up feeling more frustrating if you do tons of work on, you know, some bill that never gets passed into law, right? I mean, it's pretty easy to spend a lot of time on stuff that doesn't get used there. That said, the jobs on the Hill are great, great jobs, and our students get them all the time. And in fact, the Career Services is well set up to talk to you all about that. There's various senators offer positions over the summer or during the year. I know some of my students have applied for those. I'm sure the Career Service can talk about them. I mean, I think most jobs don't have that think tanky feel to them, and especially if you don't like that, then just avoid those few that do. You know, I think most places people get hired in the summer after school are places that really need a lawyer helping the clients they're serving. You know, and even when you just have your little minor victory for that one client and you haven't changed the world, that feels awfully good. I think that even feels better sometimes than the impact litigation where you never really see who you're helping. So I think there's a lot of jobs that can give you that sense of satisfaction.
Yeah, one of the facets of public interest law that can be sometimes mildly annoying is because when things happen, you want to, you know, you're always struggling for money, you're always trying to get people to contribute. So sometimes when you've got multiple parties, let's say multiple offices in a case, and something good happens, everybody wants to put the press release out, you know, Public Citizen won this big thing, Bazelon Center won this big thing. And when I was at Justice, we co-canceled a case with what was then the Mental Health Law Project, and it's now the Bazelon Center, a wonderful place, and I like the people there a lot. After one victory that was clearly, you know, a lot of us and some of them, they put out a press release, you know, Mental Health Law Project was a landmark case, you know, and on and on. So, of course, we'd start calling them Mr. and Mrs. Landmark. And yet, you know, we didn't need to do fundraising at the government level, so it made perfect sense. I do think government jobs, you know, DOJ being where I was, are very good for giving you a lot of responsibility in many of those offices sooner rather than later. Again, sort of the way they're structured. So, a year out of law school, you know, a year and a half out of law school, I was lead attorney on some of these cases, which is sort of scary. But, you know, that fit what I wanted to do, and that was wonderful. And, you'd go to, my wife was at that time working at a law firm, and we'd go to, like, a law firm dinner or something, and I'd be at the dinner table, and people were going around, oh, what are you doing? And, you know, somebody was a sixth-year associate. Well, I sat in on a deposition last week. What did you do? Well, I was doing I just finished a three-week trial in Alabama. You know, and so, in fact, in the clinic, this happened, it was about a month ago, we're doing, we have an employment discrimination case, we're representing a plaintiff in a disability case, and the other side, the law firm representing the defendant, was taking our client's deposition, so our students went, defended the deposition. The lawyer, who's maybe, I'd say, fourth, fifth year associate, all she did was on the laptop take notes on the deposition. The deposition was conducted by a partner. So the students, who are, you know, third year law students, are doing more in the case than, you know, the associate. And I thought that was kind of cool. And the students were great. You know, they knew what they were doing, and we prepared. And of course, that's from clinic, the reason you can do that is we spend a lot of time preparing, going back and forth what to expect, so you can walk into situations like depositions and know what you're facing and not just read about it or watch somebody do it, but actually do it yourself. Now, I know you had some questions about...
Yeah, I mean, it's really basic questions. Like, I don't really know how it works and, I mean, how much time it ends up taking and how many classes or credits, I guess, you end up using for it, or...
It's a lot of time, kind of the no pain, no gain theory. Most of the clinics are 7 credits per semester.
Okay.
Some of them are 1 semester clinics, some of them are a year, and all this is on the website, so you can take a look at that. We usually say that the 7 credit is about a 20-hour a week time commitment outside of the class piece, so that's just field work. But one of the things about being in the clinic is you've got real clients. So.
Right.
If this is a week where you've got to spend 40 hours on the case, that's what you do. And, conversely, if it's a week where not much is going on in your cases, maybe there'll be less than that. It's very much the kind of transition from world of student to world of work, and you kind of do what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
It's it needs to be that way, we think, in order to give you the, experiential learning is a very powerful kind of learning. For it to really work, you need to really be, we think, kind of immersed in it, and that requires a certain amount of time to do it. Also, it's not, the way we do it at least, it's not a very efficient kind of learning. We don't just sit there and go, okay, you're going to do these three things, boom, boom, boom. It's more like you come to us and say, okay, well, we're meeting about the case today. It's like, good. What are we going to talk about? I don't know. What do you think we ought to be doing? And, rather than us telling you, we want you to realize that you know a lot or know where to look to find out how to do various things. And so over time, we kind of get through that piece of it. And our theory is you learn more by trying to articulate for yourself, for your partner, for your supervisor, just how things ought to go. And realizing, is this something I can look up? Where would I look it up? Is it something I need to talk about with somebody? Is it something that requires experience that I don't have? How am I going to get that? Mm-hmm. To really be very thoughtful and reflective about what you're doing. One thing I would say, just because this just came up, we just now announced clinic selections for mm-hmm. next year. And I got an email just the other day from a student who said, I'd really like to do the disability rights clinic. I didn't apply because I was going to work, and then it turns out I'm not going to work, and it really, is there any possibility? And I had to write back to her and say, well, I feel that everybody who applied by the deadline has to be considered before you, it's only fair. So if it turns out that someone drops, or drops late in the summer when it's hard to replace them, and we've gone to everybody else who applied in time, and all those people say no, then if there's an opening, we'll consider you. But what I really wanted to say to her was, if you think you might do it, why not apply? And then, if it turns out you don't want to, you can always say no. There were about three or four people who just missed the deadline in that way. Now, some might have, their plans might have changed. Others just didn't meet the deadline. And, because we do real cases, it's one of those things we look at and say, this is not just like, oh, it'd be nice to get it in. It's like if you're in court and you don't meet a deadline, your client sometimes can lose his or her case. So, and we give you plenty of time, and it's all online now. It's really easy to do. It's one of those tests, it's one of those tests of seriousness. So I really feel free to share this with your colleagues, but if you're just thinking it might be something you might want to do, better to, to apply, and then you can always decide, okay, things have changed, whereas if you decide later, that's a little odd.
I actually have a question, because this has been coming up a lot when students come to see me, is for some of the clinics where you can actually get in your second year, if you decide to say no and turn them down in hopes of doing it the third year, is there any sort of black mark against you?
You mean other than the you're dead to us file?
Yeah.
No, there isn't. And because there might be very good reason. For example, you might apply, what happens sometimes is you've got several clinics, but if you got your first choice, you would do it as a second year, and you might have listed other choices, but if it's... if you didn't get your first choice, even though we give you a position, you might say, well, I'd rather wait to the third year and still try for that. So, and we do give preference to third-year students. So,
do most third-year students get in, or is there a good chance that you just are asked?
There's a very good chance you will get in. You don't necessarily get your first choice.
Okay.
We strive very hard to say that we will give every third-year student an opportunity to do a clinic. And we have been able to achieve that, I think, for about the last five or so years. Now, that doesn't mean that I can say for certain we always will, because it is a resource question. But we try very hard to take third years over second years. Now, right now, just because we're right in this process, there is a waiting list which has a few third year students on it, maybe 8 or 10. And the thought is that because of people who may decide not to do it now, or may decide over the summer the circumstances change, the likelihood is there will be enough folks that all those people will have a chance. Now, sometimes what happens is somebody says, they sort of single bullet, I only want human rights clinic, and that's the only choice, and they don't get it. And then we would still say to them, you can be considered for an opening another clinic if you want, and again, depends on whether it's so oriented towards a specific subject that you just say that or nothing. But if you're willing to be flexible, we will try very hard to sort of get a clinic. But in answer, Laura, to your question, there is no... we don't even really look. I notice when someone has applied second year and didn't get in, applies again, and I think of that as an indication of really strong interest. The fact that you turned it down, especially if you have a good story to tell, not just, I turned it down because I like turning people. people there. but
I think what students are finding is perhaps that they've overcommitted themselves, potentially that they're doing Marshall Brennan and law review and they don't know where to fit it in, and they're thinking, how can I make this the best experience for me and for my potential client?
Right. I will say what we ask people to do is think very carefully when they say they're going to do it that they really mean, because we do get people who say, beginning of August, you know, I was really wanting to do it, now I'm not so sure, or I had a great summer job, it looks like it could stay on. I think they want me to work more hours than it feels like I can do when doing clinics, so I'm not going to do it. And the problem, and they might even be thinking, I'm not really hurting the clinic because I know there were all these other people who didn't get in, so they'll just go to the next person. The problem is, if you've applied and you don't get in, my experience is, you know, people, as they should, make alternative plans. And so you wind up calling people, trying to reach people the week before classes start, which is not always the easiest thing to do, and say, oh, you're interested in this. You can't reach them. And so then you wind up with fewer than the number you really want. And more importantly, that somebody who really would have benefited from it didn't get to do it. Now, you know, things, we're not so rigid. I mean, we understand that things do change, but we would ask people that when they first have that choice, is, you know, what, am I really, if I have questions about things like my other schedules, like to really think through them. And not wait till the end to do it. But it is an important thing to think about, because, you know, if you're pressed for time and the issue is, do I do this thing which a client who, you know, who may be depending on this to keep her child or to keep out of jail, versus, you know, spend time in this other interesting project, you know, we're just gonna not even say anything. We're just gonna look at you and say, is this even a choice?
Just a double check quickly. Clinics aren't available for evening or weekend.
No, they aren't.
Oh, they are.
Were
you
there at the second conference that we did? I thought you were. Maybe I'm wrong. The one just a couple weeks ago.
Yes, I was.
You remember Karen Holman, a third-year student, or fourth-year student, part-time?
Yes.
She had a fabulous experience doing the clinic. The disability clinic, actually. Karen Holman. Anyway. And she had a wonderful experience, and among other things, got the highest grade in the class, which, you know, she was working a full-time job while doing that, so that shows how doable it
is. We have one clinic which is actually specifically designed for part-time students. It's our evening division of the general practice clinic. It's fewer credits, because part-time students, it's harder, you know, if you take 7 credits, not going to be so many more credits you can take. I think it's 5 credits for them. And Dave Chapkin, who usually teaches that, works really closely with the students, understanding ways in which if you're working full-time, that just some things that in the day section we would have the students do, but we try to facilitate that for the part-time. Now, next year, in my disability clinic, I think I have 2 part-time students who may not be, I don't think they're working full-time, but, you know, they have scheduled, arranged their schedule in such a way that they can do it. So it really depends on the clinic, I think, that and the kind of, you know, are you working full-time, and if you are working full-time, what kind of flexibility will your employer give you? I think those are the kind of questions. But we have several, you know, it's in other clinics sprinkled, but in particular the evening clinic, it's focused on that.
I don't know if this is the right place to bring this up or not, but I've worked in D.C. before and discovered the Inspector General office, which when I was thinking about law school, I was like, okay, so if the Republicans stay in office, how, you know, like, where would I go? And I was like, oh, I could do that, like, keeping them honest, that would be great. So I was just wondering if you knew anything about that work and, like, what would prepare, I mean, like, the investigation seems sort of similar to Discovery, but not really.
Well, what kind of, I mean, my understanding is there's Inspector Generals for a bunch of different agencies, and you're talking about one. So you're talking about many.
I was thinking like EPA or DOI.
Yeah.
Or environmental,
you know, they do great work. And by the way, you know, I think every administration needs good Inspector Generals. I mean, you know, the power corrupts line, what have you. I think it's great. It's an important place to work.
I think this is the great thing I think about law school, which is that most of the things you learn are not really the substantive subjects. I mean, it's learning how to learn. It's becoming, it's like if you get a problem that comes across your desk, say, okay, I know how to approach this. And we certainly do a lot of that in clinic. So when I would say with investigation, again, are you a good writer? Are you organized? Can you read through complex factual scenarios and understand them? That's all stuff you do, you know, in any class, right? You're trying to work through that. And a lot of it is really more almost work skills than it is the substantive knowledge. Another whole way to look at when you're looking at jobs is taking care of, you know, business first, that is paying attention to your courses, doing well as much as you can, is going to help you a lot, and particularly if, of course, in the area that you're interested in. But a lot of times that's what employers are looking for. They're looking for young, smart people who demonstrated that they've got, you know, have done well, and then presuppose from that that, that they'll be able to pick up on things that are presented to them.
You should look and see, try to get a summer job in a, if you're interested still in an IG office, because I think that'd be a great way to see whether you like the work, because it's a little different from your typical lawyer work, even though, as I agree with Bob, that you learned skills that will help you with that job in law school.
And I know of a couple attorneys at IG that actually picked up a badge and a gun and became officers. It's an option.
Wow, that would be a change. We don't teach you about that in law school. There's no requirement.
I think we have a recourse, you know, carrying concealed weapons in the law.
Recourse.
I'm really sorry. I had to come in late.
No worries.
You covered this already, and I was just repeating. Feel free to tell me. But I'm really pretty much exclusively interested in public interest as a career after school. So one of the things I'm struggling with in terms of like course selection is, of course, I'm gravitating towards all of the, you know, interesting sounding classes, and gravitating away from things that sound, you know, like administrative law, evidence. I recognize those are important, obviously.
Those are two we actually said you should take.
What I was
going to say is, what proportion of sort of like more foundational classes to sort of like the really, you know, exciting sounding, I mean, evidence and admin are already on my list, but beyond that, what, you know, I'm having a hard time deciding.
Can you give an example of what you mean by an exciting sounding course?
Women's legal history, or women in conflict, or feminist jurisprudence, which I know is closed, but, you know, I'm more attracted to sort of the seminar courses, just because they're more specifically focused, and less attracted to, you know, BA or sales. I don't want to leave school and not be a lawyer, you know what I mean? Like, I recognize that it's really important to get those foundational skills because that's kind of the essence of lawyering. But I'm just wondering, like, what's a good balance?
Well, I never took sales. I never took wills. Actually, I'm not sure what I took in law school because I can mostly see what I didn't take. I decided, for example, that it'd be good to have a course that dealt with commercial things because I didn't think I understood that so well. But I took consumer protection because I thought that would be more interesting in terms of what I was caring about. And, you know, I'd still learn Article 2 and Article 9, and I wouldn't have to take sales and security or something like that. My suggestion, and not just for you, but generally, is I think too often we kind of do planning a little too incrementally. Okay, what are we doing next semester? You know, it's pre-registration. What's there? I would look at it as I've got, you know, 4 terms left if you're first year student. Let me block out some things. You know, you're not going to want to take 3-4 credit courses the same semester, because 4 credit courses, you know, you're going to take evidence. Maybe you say, you know what, I'm going to take evidence in the fall, and you know, maybe I'll take BA, but maybe not the same semester. Maybe I'll take that in the spring. I need to figure out what I'm going to do my upper level writing, and maybe if you like seminars, that's not going to be a problem because you're going to be writing a lot. But I don't necessarily want to have 3 high writing courses the same semester because that's going to be a thing. So, you know, you start plugging in a little bit. If you're thinking about clinic, you think, well, that's a big credit allocation. But when am I going to do that? Am I going to try to do it second year? Am I going to try to do it third year? Am I going to do it 1 semester or 2 semesters? If I'm interested in an externship, also a big credit, that's a good second year thing to do because it's a way to immediately get out into the thing. So I kind of block it. And then, of course, there's always the vagaries of, can you get into what you want to get into? And, you know, do you want this is the course you want, it's not the prof you want, so how much are you going to play that? But I would look at that, because otherwise you kind of, I think I see sometimes with students, it's like they're on a boat that's completely leaning one direction. One of my clinic students now took 18 credits the first semester, and this semester all she has is clinic. Looking at that, I'd say balance would have been better. You know, now I know why I hardly saw her first semester. But, you know, in her mind, and she had a plan. It was, I want to get to the last semester where I'm only working on clinic, and the only way to do that is to heavy up in the fall semester. And, you know, that works for her, but I think you also have to know your own thing. But that's what one of the things I would say is look to see how to balance them so it's not all one way, one semester or another.
And, you know, you asked specifically for myself, and I would suggest for you, but, you know yourself better than I know you, and you should discard this advice if you don't like it. But I would say limit those kinds of seminar courses to maybe 25 to 30% of your overall courses. And, I mean, that's a lot. That's one a semester, right? Like, you know, and I think and maybe one semester do two. And then have some big, solid sort of evidence, administrative law type courses, BA maybe. And then hopefully you can find some courses that kind of both interest you and give you some doctrine, right? The seminars are more about writing and about really digging deep into some area, substance, or theory that you're interested in. That's great. But I think it's good to have some, if you want to be a lawyer when you get a litigator, some more doctrinal courses too. So you actually asked for the balance I would pick for myself, so of course I recommend it for others, but maybe it doesn't fit for you, would be to do sort of one of those types of seminars a semester, and then three other courses, probably maybe two each semester as well, that aren't those sort of specialty seminar kinds of courses.
But see, I also would look at it and say, and we did talk a little bit about this earlier, you might want to take, I would say don't graduate from law school without taking one pretty heavy statutory-oriented course, because that's something which lawyers do all the time. Now, environmental law is a heavy statutory course. Tax is a heavy statutory. There's lots of others. So, you know, within that kind of menu, and you won't necessarily see that in our guide in this way, say, well, I'm going to make sure I take that, because it's reading statutes. There's a kind of similarity to that. Actually, you can take a Amanda's course next year on statutory interpretation. You'll know all you need to know about that. But the point of it is, like, that's kind of more, I think, maybe skill-oriented. But I also agree that too many of the same kind of course isn't always the best thing. And it may look, and here's the other thing, is you have to think a little bit about how this sort of looks to the world. If you're dealing with something where every title of something has got something that, you know, looks so public interesting, and you decide at the end of third year, not that you've given up that dream, but, you know, for loan repayment, whatever it is, you need to be a little more of a generalist, you may run up against, you know, that problem. And so, whereas if you take some of those other courses, the main reason to take is to learn what they're there, but it also makes a lot of sense to people. Oh, okay, administrative law course then.
Well, not even public interest. I mean, if I was, you know, I was at a public interest organization for a while and we hired, and I wouldn't want to see someone only on their resume, you know, law and popular culture, you know, legal history. Like, I would want to see that they had some practical lawyering courses, because that's what I'm hiring them to do. So it's not as if, I don't even consider those courses public interest in a way. Like, I think public interest folks want to hire people with lots of skills, right? So, and lots of knowledge. So I'm not just putting those courses down. Those are great. I teach a seminar myself. You know, please take it. But it's just a different kind of a course than the doctrinal
public interest
bigger subject area courses that'll be on the bar, and that'll be stuff you probably will have to draw from in your practice.
Yeah, and again, there's all these ought to be thought of as kind of rules of thumb guidance. I mean,
yeah.
There's so many variations on it, and again, a lot of times we say, well, you might want to do this, and then you start thinking about what you did yourself, and it doesn't bear any relationship to what we're saying. Now, sometimes that's in response to the fact that, oh, I wished I would have done more this or that. And what I was saying earlier about really think about taking the professor, because if you're connected with somebody, that's something I did some of in law school, but I would now have done, going back, and if I knew then what I know now, I'd say I'd do more of that. Just because you just don't know what kind of connection that is. You know, it could be, I mean, that's a wonderful thing about teaching, that sometimes you realize that you touch people who, you know, the rest of their lives have changed the direction they went in. And, you know, that's a special thing to do, and you can't always kind of figure it out by the title of the course.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
All right, well, we expect you all to take great courses
yeah.
to become wonderful public interest lawyers, and, you know, come back and tell us.
I do have an off-topic question.